Welcome to the Share Movie Media Podcast, brought to you by the Journal of Healthcare Contracting and Repertoire Magazine. And now, here's your host, publisher Scott Adams.
Hello everyone, Scott Adams here with Share Movie Media. I have the pleasure today of interviewing Paul Mango. For those of you who don't know who Paul is, he has a book coming out on Operation Warp Speed around the vaccines and how they got to market so fast. This is an interesting story. Whether you're on the supply chain side of our audience or whether you're on the distribution side of our audience, he talks about so many of you in it. And the thing that's so exciting to me is where he talks about the government getting out of the way and letting the private sector, one, get the vaccine to market as fast as possible. But two, we also talk about Operation Airbridge when we were on shortages of PPE all over this country and the government worked with McKesson and Shine and Owens and Medline and Cardinal and all of the distributors around the country to help get those things in from Asia into the hands of folks that needed it. Let me give you a little background on Paul. First and foremost, Paul's married to his wife, Dawn Rucker, who graduated from West Point in the class of 1982. They had five daughters and they currently live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. But what I talked to Paul about was where he was in 2020 and 2021. Paul was the deputy chief of staff for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from 2019 to 2021. During that time, he was instrumental in advancing a number of important policies, which we all know today from the healthcare sector around COVID-19. One was Operation Airbridge, which got PPE here so rapidly and in the hands of folks. What would have normally taken 90 days to 120 days, they were doing in 2 days, thanks to stepping back and getting product brought across on aircraft versus in containers like it comes today. He was also he served the secretary and was the formal liaison for Operation Warp Speed, which was incredibly strategic in everything from operations to financial aspects in getting the vaccine to market faster than any vaccine's ever been brought to market in the history of our country. This story, to me, is an American story. It's a cool story of how we were in, for lack of a better term, a war with this virus, and people behind the scenes who you would never know about were doing miraculous things, and they had no idea what was coming at them. This, we all were dealing with this for the first time. If you take and step back for a second before you listen to this podcast and remember where you were when you found out we were going to shelter in place for 14 days, and the fact that I'm talking about this 2 years later and we're still dealing with COVID as an industry, as a country, as a world population, it is an incredible story. I hope you get a lot out of this podcast. It was a fun conversation to have. So here we go. Hello, everyone. Scott Adams here. I am on the phone today with Paul Mango. Paul, it's so good to have you on the call, and I am looking forward to talking to you about the strategic national stockpile, basically, and where we were with Operation Airbridge back during the pandemic. And then also, I want to talk a lot about today about Operation Warp Speed and your involvement there and get into your book that's coming out. But thank you so much for being on the podcast with me today.
Hey, Scott, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, my audience was very instrumental in a lot of this. And so I think they're going to be excited to hear kind of the behind the scenes that went into it. I know when it was going on, I was trying to interview as many of these distributors and some of the manufacturers that were making COVID tests. And they're like, we can't talk about this right now. So I know that they're thrilled to have folks here and know what they did and what they went through during that time and just how everybody pulled together. It was from afar watching it. It was really unique to watch our industry come together, even competitors, and work together side by side. And I think you and your team had a ton to do with that. So I'm going to jump right into the questions with you this morning. And let's just, I'm anxious to have this conversation. So really excited about it. Let me start out with kind of Operation Airbridge. Let's start there and then we'll morph into Operation Warp Speed. So when we talk about the strategic national stockpile, which all of my listeners are very familiar with, when in those early days, kind of when the pandemic broke out and, you know, you guys were developing strategy and how to collaborate around that, you worked specifically with medical distributors, supply chain distributors. You know, can you talk about, you know, what the potential shortages were, what they look like, and kind of what the experience was during those times?
Yeah, absolutely, Scott. And I mean, I think the top line is all hell was breaking loose. But very early in the pandemic in February, when we started experiencing hospital admissions and then some of the initial fatalities here in the United States, one of the things I did was called out to six or seven large health systems that were treating these patients, because we wanted to know what was the supply consumption associated with a COVID patient. In the early days, it was a 10-day length of stay on average. And I remember calling Providence out in Seattle. They had some of the first cases, and the clinical medical director out there was very gracious and with her time. And she said, Paul, we're going through 350 N95 masks per patient. Okay. Now that's over a 10-day length of stay. So we, you know, started doing the math, and we come back to our strategic national stockpile. We had 12 million N95 masks, right? So you can start to figure out that, you know, after 40,000 patients or so, the cupboards are going to be bare. And we were expecting obviously a lot more. And I think, you know, there wound up being millions and millions of hospitalizations. So we had to develop, as you suggested, a strategy very quickly to figure out how we're going to get supplies to those geographies and those institutions, those hospitals and health systems that needed them most. And we put a team together to try to understand where all of the PPE was manufactured. So you had masks, you had gowns, you had, obviously you had like booties, you had nitrile gloves. And what we learned, of course, which shouldn't be a surprise to any of your audience, is that the vast majority of these were manufactured outside the United States. So yeah. Nitrile gloves, it was like 98% outside the country. And 95 masks, we actually made quite a few. But then when it came to gowns, no, they were sewn in Mexico or someplace in South America, right? So we developed this strategy, and I think you previewed it a bit. You talked about the air bridge, but our strategy actually had four major components. Acceleration, which was the air bridge, and I want to come back to that in a second. But then there was a part of it that was called reallocation, a third part called preservation, and a fourth part called repatriation. And I'll go through each of these, but acceleration basically was a function of us working with these great medical supply company distributors. I mean, I'll just give you, you know, it was obviously McKesson and Henry Schein and Quidel and Abbott and Owens and Minor. I think Cardinal was very instrumental, Cepheid, you know, great American iconic companies. And they had rights to a lot of this PPE that was in China. Wuhan, ironically, was a place where a lot of PPE was manufactured, and they had to shut down their factories for 6 weeks during the early days of COVID. When they resumed production, they had been filling up their warehouses with stuff that these medical supply companies owned, but they were in warehouses in China. And if they put them on the normal kind of transportation route on large container ships coming back to the States, it would have taken 45 days to get here, then unloaded, and then put on trains or trucks from the West Coast and then into the country. Could it be, you know, 55, 60 days, 2 months? So what we decided was, and this was the fundamental nature of the air bridge, is that the federal government would send a series of 747 cargo jets over to these warehouses in China. The medical distributors would still own 100% of the product that we picked up. But in return for us financing that transportation, which on the slim margins that these companies have, they never could have financed it on their own and made any margin. So in return for what we did, the companies permitted us to direct the allocation of 50% of whatever we picked up. And this was critical because in the early days of the pandemic and throughout most of the pandemic, 2 years in, there were real spikes in certain parts of the country in terms of infections, hospitalizations, and in other parts of the country, it was barely affected. So our ability to take a constrained supply base and redirect it to the hotspots was crucial to the long-term success. And these, you know, these medical suppliers and distributors that I mentioned, these guys, you know, they were such patriots. I have to say, they exhibited no self-interest whatsoever. They were all a team. And one of the things we had to do, Scott, was use what's called Defense Production Act Title VII, which permitted normal competitors to collaborate during this time of a public health emergency. And one of the ways they collaborated was along with Palantir, which is a great information technology company, we created an information technology system that gave us line of sight into where every N95 mask, every gown, wow, you know, every booty, wherever it was, from the factory to the warehouse to where it was being shipped in the country. And so we had this decision support system that was phenomenal that the distributors never had on their own. And now we had one. It's really a national asset, if you think about it. And that permitted us to reallocate. So again, the first principle was acceleration. That was getting things that would normally take 2 months and getting them here overnight. Once we did that, it was around using this IT system to say, we need to send more gowns to Mount Sinai in New York because New York is blowing up with cases right now. And obviously that would mean that these suppliers would have to short some of their other customers, but those would be customers that didn't have the same need at that time. The third part of our strategy was called preservation. And I talked about Providence and, you know, we talked to Kaiser, we talked to a number of other hospitals and health systems. And what we decided was we were going to get them on the phone. And the American Hospital Association helped us with this. It'd be at, like at 8 o'clock at night and we'd be in Secretary Azar's conference room and we'd have 2,000 participants from hospitals around the country listening to those leaders in the hospitals that were treating COVID patients and saying, listen, this is what we learned this week. If you do this, the patient, you know, is not only better off, but you preserve PPE. And you know, this is where the notion of COVID wings came up. So hospitals created COVID wings where they put all the COVID patients together, for instance, right? And then the last part was, and I think this is really important for your audience, the last part of our strategy was called repatriation. And that was to begin to bring production back to the United States, even during the pandemic. And we issued, I think, close to $500 million worth of grants to expand domestic manufacturing capacity of masks, of gloves, and other things. And one of the things we learned, and I'll pause, I know you have a couple other questions, but one of the things we learned, which I thought was fascinating, was that a lot of this stuff was offshored 20 years ago, when labor arbitrage opportunities were significant. Two things have happened in the interim period of time. One is labor costs around the world have normalized a bit. I mean, it's still not equal, but they've normalized a bit. But the second one was after we offshored a lot of this stuff, the Asians applied all types of automation techniques and equipment to manufacture this. So what we learned when we started looking at repatriation was with this automated equipment, America was actually a cost-advantaged place to manufacture the same stuff 20 years later. And nitrile gloves in particular, the base raw material for that is petroleum. And petroleum is a lot cheaper in Louisiana and Mississippi and Texas than it is in Vietnam. So we actually had a potential cost advantage by bringing this back, but they needed an initial capital investment to invest in the equipment necessary to do this on an automated basis. And that's what we funded. So anyway, just to summarize, acceleration was the air bridge. Reallocation was the tremendous collaborative effort with all the medical supply distributors in the country, along with Palantir's IT system. Preservation was getting the hospitals to exchange best practices in real time. And then repatriation is bringing manufacturing back. That was our total strategy for the strategic national stockpile and making sure we took care of Americans during the early days of the pandemic.
So a couple of things there. that I want to unpack, because we're on this podcast, we're reaching both of our audiences here at Share Moving Media. My healthcare supply chain executive audience is going to get this podcast, but also the distribution audience. And I would say the average distribution rep out there who was dealing with this early on, especially with the PPE stuff, 100%, the stress level was off the charts for them, because they were having to tell clients they couldn't get stuff. So one of the things that you said there that I think is really key for when we're talking about Operation Airbridge is the 50% that was controlled by the government as to things are going to go to hotspots. So, you know, my distribution reps would have clients calling them in, I'm just going to make a place up, you know, Sarasota, Florida, where there wasn't a hotspot, they couldn't ship certain things. And those end users were aggravated by that, but it's like, it's because we're sending it where we need it. And I think that's really key. I think 2 years later, people probably recognize that, but they're in the throes of that for sure. And then to go to the next step where we talk about, you know, the offshoring 20 years ago, I was in the glove business for about 10 years and they are produced in Southern Asia. The company that I work for is the largest rubber producer in the world. And at that time, latex gloves were the main used product. It moved to nitrile over the next 20 years. But once those factories are in place and all of that infrastructure is built, it makes sense to continue doing it there. To your exact point, the raw material for not latex comes from Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia. Those are the three largest countries in the world for that. So that's why it was there. But when I started in that, Paul, our factory might have had 5,000 to 7,000 people working in it. Today, that same factory creating probably 2 to 3 times as much might have 500 people.
Yeah.
Because exactly what you said, the automation. So bringing that stuff to the US is key, especially on things like masks and gowns, because you can set those factories up quick. You want to build a glove factory? That's a football field long factory, 6 stories high, and takes about 2 years from start to finish, and is probably, to have enough lines to make a difference, $100 million investment.
Yeah, well, it was and at the time, Scott, you're exactly right. It was per line, it was $20 to $25 million of capital investment.
Yep.
Your point, a factory might have 5, 6, 7 lines to make it really critical mass.
Yeah, if you're going to produce enough volume to do it, but I hear exactly what you're saying, and we do need to have that stuff brought back to the States 100%. Let's talk a little bit about those early days, kind of the day-to-day, minute-to-minute, you know, how did the MedSurg distributors, and, you know, I'm talking McKesson, Shine, Owens, Cardinal, Medline, you know, how did those folks work hand-to-hand, you know, during Operation Airbridge? Because I can tell you, and when we have industry meetings, one of the first things that's read is, hey, we're not here to talk pricing. We can't. And you just made a comment that I forget what article you said it was, but they were actually allowed to start working together. So talk a little bit about that early on with those 5 to 7 national distributors that really stepped up to the plate.
Yeah, it was just, you know, a DPA Title VII is what I referred to a little bit earlier, but, it was very interesting because early in the pandemic, HHS started collaborating closely with FEMA. And FEMA, obviously the Federal Emergency Management Administration, is expert at kind of responding to disasters, as we all know, right? Whether that's floods or hurricanes, tornadoes. And they had a number of representatives and parts of their organization that were distributed across 10 regions in the United States. And they were logistical hubs for various things. So this was a very important joint venture between Health and Human Services and FEMA. And I remember I'd show up at FEMA at 7:30 every morning, and at 8 o'clock or so, we would have our initial call with all of these distributors. And this wasn't like, you know, 4 levels down. The CEOs were on the phone for a good number of these calls. I mean, this is how committed they were. The CEOs themselves were committed. And we took a posture, Scott, I think it's very important because maybe there's some contrast with the current administration. But we took the posture that the private sector knows best what to do.
Yep.
We need to elicit their input and their ideas. And our role was to coordinate them, not to tell them what to do. So these calls were really about them informing us of the best way to get this done. And we'd have morning calls and we'd have late afternoon calls every day because that's how fast the situation was changing. And again, the commitment on the part of these companies with literally their CEOs in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, on these calls. And so we had the right leadership at the table, and it was real-time problem solving. Okay, this happened or that happened, or we couldn't get to this warehouse in China, or the plane went to the wrong place. I mean, you know, it wasn't perfect. Obviously, it's the fog of war, literally, right? But we got through it, and you know, we got into a rhythm. And once we got into that rhythm, it was absolutely fantastic. I should mention, you know, FedEx and UPS and others who helped us with the air bridge itself. I don't want to leave them out because, yeah, again, great American iconic companies that kind of just stepped right up. And I remember I was in the Oval Office once. We were briefing the president on Airbridge, quite honestly. And, you know, Fred Smith from FedEx had just finished a conversation with the president and said, anything you need from FedEx, we're here to help. We'll send planes anywhere in the world, right? So it's just really phenomenal American response. And, you know, like I said, it was very hectic for the first few weeks. But once we got into a rhythm, just like you could imagine with American industry, it was really humming. And it was very impressive to see the assets and the resources and the talent that these companies brought to bear. And I think it made a big difference on saving a lot of lives. I'll tell you, in the fall of 2020, Scott, Deb Burks, we were looking at who to prioritize for vaccinations. And there was a big debate. This is actually, I don't want to get into my book right now, but I talk about this in my book about, do we vaccinate truly the elderly and those who are most vulnerable, or do we vaccinate first our healthcare workers, our frontline healthcare workers, because we can't have them out of action and take care of the people who needed to be taken care of. And Deb Burks quoted, this was in October of 2020. She said, out of 20 million healthcare workers in the United States, only 200,000 have been infected. Now, you're talking about people who are in contact with COVID patients every day. The reason they weren't infected is because of the success of the air bridge in these companies, because we did get PPE to the right place at the right time. So I'm just raising that because I think, you know, for your listeners, they saved a lot of lives. And maybe the average rep on the street was frustrated and didn't realize that, but hopefully they feel some level of fulfillment from the impact that they and their companies had on American lives, and particularly frontline healthcare workers.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, Paul, you may not be aware of this, but I publish a 28-year-old magazine that goes to the 6,500 distribution reps across the country every month that are calling on hospitals, nursing homes, physician office, surgery centers. And I want to make sure I'm clear that when I say they were frustrated, it was these guys have been calling on these practices and these facilities for sometimes 15, 20 years. They have personal relationships with these folks, and they saw the stress on their faces and the fact they couldn't get them things. And it was more of a feeling like they were letting their friends down who are in harm's way. And they really weren't. We were doing what was best. I love that you brought up those CEOs of those distributors were there and on the phone in the morning. I know our industry is fairly small, but so important. And it became the front page of every newspaper for almost 2 years, or at least 6 to 8 months around the whole getting PPE products there. And I'll never forget the day that they were all at the White House, and we did a cover story on it the very next month with the White House was our cover. And just the fact that our industry was front and center. And I've never been prouder of working in this industry than I was for that. And I'll make one more comment, and then I want to ask one more question on the airbridge piece, and then we can move over to Operation Warp Speed. But the simple fact that you guys stepped aside as a government and said, hey, we've already got private sector involved in this that have expertise in moving this, whether it's FedEx, UPS, or any of the distributors, Schein, McKesson, Owens, pushing this stuff out was brilliant. It literally should be a case study for anytime we deal with these things going forward.
Yeah.
Of, can the private sector do it better? More than likely, how do we get out of the way and let them? When you and I talked last week on this, that when you said that, it hit me, you know, square between the eyes of, this is about private sector and the accomplishment of it, not necessarily what the government just got out of the way, which to me is as big a challenge as, you know, as yeah. the private sector taking on and doing it. So anyhow, just, I had to give a little bit of love to my distribution guys there. I'll get back on track here. Give us a couple of lessons you learned and some things that we might be able to avoid if we face this again, which we probably will.
Yeah, well, obviously coming back to the strategic national stockpile, we were fundamentally unprepared for what hit us. And the mission of that stockpile had a lot to do with chemical, biological, nuclear warfare. And in the early days of the Trump administration, a lot of people don't remember this, but the biggest threat to this country in 2016, 17, going into early 18 was North Korea. So a lot of the effort of the Strategic National Stockpile and a lot of the resources went into, let's just call it antidotes that would protect America against, you know, nuclear threats and those types of things. So we weren't prepared for a biological threat like this. And I think, you know, that is one thing that has to change. And I know it has changed. When I left, I think I quoted the figure that when we started in early 2020, we had 12 million N95 masks. When I left, we had close to 300 million in the stockpile.
Good grief.
That's one. I think two is a lesson learned is, and I hope we don't repeat the mistakes of the past here, but it is the government dramatically increased demand for certain supplies during the pandemic. And unfortunately, we even saw this with testing in the fall. Once that demand goes away, the supply goes away. And then it's very difficult to respond to the next pandemic in this case. So there needs to be a way where the federal government can continue to fund the presence of idle capacity that is, quote, warm and can be hot very quickly. And I think the level of collaboration that needs to take place between the Strategic National Stockpile, these medical supply distributors, but also the manufacturers, to ensure that that is in place and to test it multiple times a year, you know, to pressure test it, I think is absolutely required. And the federal government's going to have to pay for that. But it is significantly cheaper than the trillions of dollars of lost economic growth and everything else we experienced because we weren't prepared. And I think the third and last, I'll just say, because this kind of maybe is a segue into Operation Warp Speed, it's the reiteration of the message you suggested, which is the federal government's role in an emergency like this is to enable the private sector to be successful, but it has to depend on that private sector to deliver the success. The government enables, the private sector delivers. And I have to say, in our administration, it started right at the top. You had a president who was a businessman. You had a Secretary of Health and Human Services, the first one ever who had spent 10 years in the pharmaceutical industry as a senior executive, right? So it was a business mindset that had a fundamental and inveterate belief in the private sector. And hopefully that lesson is not lost either.
Yeah, I've been on the Hill several times in the last probably 6-7 years lobbying about the stockpile and making sure we have it and trying to figure out how does that work, because it's one thing to just load up warehouses full of things, but you and I talked about this, I think, in another conversation. When you load up a warehouse that has, you just threw out a number of 35 million to 300 million masks mm-hmm. that have a shelf life on them.
Yeah, five year shelf life for N95 masks.
Yeah, they've got to be able to rotate and flow through and working through that. And until you're in this situation, it all sounds good on paper. When you start looking at the dollars that generates, it's unbelievable. I do want to shift gears on you here and move over to Operation Warp Speed. Can you tell the audience how it started?
Yeah, it's actually a very interesting story. So in the early days of the pandemic, even in January of 2020, the early stages of Operation Warp Speed had begun. Moderna was working with the National Institutes of Health in before the pandemic broke out on using the mRNA technology to develop cancer therapies. And when the viral sequence, the DNA sequence of the virus, coronavirus, was posted on January 10th of 2020, Moderna and the NIH said, hey, why don't we see if we can use this mRNA technology to develop a vaccine very quickly. It had never been done before. mRNA is a new vaccine technology. It had not been done before. And in about 10 days, they actually had a good vaccine, believe it or not. They didn't know it. We didn't know it. But what was developed in those first 10 days is basically what Moderna eventually distributed. But at the time, there were about 95 vaccine candidates that were being developed around the world. And when I say at that time, this was probably early March of 2020. And we started funding a number of companies to accelerate their development. And I was in Secretary Azar's office on March 28th of 2020. And his assistant walked in and handed me a note and said, Alex Gorsky would like to talk to the secretary. And Alex Gorsky was actually a good friend of mine. He was the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, but we were at West Point together in the 80s, in the early 80s. And so he gets on the phone and he wanted to thank the secretary for a $450 million grant that BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority underneath HHS, had given to Johnson & Johnson that day. Neither the secretary nor I knew anything about it, and which was a problem. But you know, of course, he went through the niceties and said thanks for calling, and then he asked me to get the BARDA folks into the conference room, and we sat him down. I think it was the next morning. Sat him down and asked him, "What'd we get for our $450 million?" And the head of BARDA at the time said, well, they're going to start their phase one clinical trial in September. And Alex Azar, who's a great pharmaceutical executive, said, wait a minute, that sounds like business as usual. There's no way we're going to let them start their phase one clinical trial, you know, 5 months from now. So we sat down and got Peter Marks from the FDA and Bob Kadlec from ASPR, Secretary Azar, myself. And Azar basically mapped out the strategy for Operation Warp Speed, the architecture, which was everything that used to be done in series will now be done in parallel. And the financial risk associated with that, for instance, starting manufacturing now, even though we don't know whether the vaccine is going to be authorized by the FDA, let's start manufacturing now. All of the financial risk for that would be assumed by the federal government. So basically, it was March 28th and March 29th that was the real impetus for what became Operation Warp Speed, architected by Secretary Alex Azar, but then obviously supported by, again, the tremendous private sector. We can talk about that in a minute, but that's how it started. And, you know, it had a number of principles around governance, around doing things in parallel and assuming financial risk, around spreading our investment risks across three platforms, three technology platforms, mRNA, viral vector, and then a protein subunit. And again, another very important principle was to bring in private sector expertise right into the government to help lead it. And that was Dr. Moncef Slaoui and Carlo De Natale Stefani, who was our manufacturing lead. So that's how it started. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
I want to talk a little bit about some of those guiding principles that you guys use, but I want to ask this question because I want to make sure I heard you right. March 28th, 29th of 2020 is when this was outlined.
Yes, that's correct. Now there had been some early work done, obviously, on screening the world for vaccines, investment in Moderna, which happened earlier than that, but it wasn't a coherent initiative. It didn't have a governance structure. Right. It didn't have a strategy. It was a little bit of let's plant the 1,000 seeds and see if something grows. And Azar right away got it and said, no, this needs to change dramatically.
So I'm 51, so my memory is a little less than it used to be. When did we start flattening the curve? Like March 1st, 2nd, somewhere right at the beginning of March, right? In 2020?
Flatten the curve. You mean the
shelter in place, kind of the 14 days to where we were.
Oh, yeah, that was that started in late March because it was.
Wow. So you guys were intuitive enough to jump on.
Yeah.
Operation Warp Speed at the same time before anybody really realized. I've been in this industry for almost 30 years. And at that time, and I don't know if I want to say shame on me, or I was brushing this off as it's another bird flu. It's this, it's that, it's just like flu. It's going to be seasonal. Never in my wildest dreams would I have thought 2 years later, I'm interviewing you about Operation Warp Speed over a virus. And yeah, for you guys to have had the intuitiveness to, we need to look at a vaccine for this immediately and start looking at, we can't take 10 years to get a vaccine to market on this. We've got to move. It's just right. Incredible. Talk a little bit about some of those guiding principles that help with the effort of doing that once you guys put it on the back of the napkin, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Well, the most important one, as I talked about, was performing activities in parallel as much as possible. And the typical approach, and a very rational, logical approach of a pharmaceutical company, is to go through a phase one trial, examine those results, start a phase two trial a couple months or even a year later, examine those results, go into phase three human, large scale human trials, take it to the FDA. The FDA could take 6 months to evaluate data. I'll come back to this, but Peter Marks made a pledge of any data I get, any application I get for an EUA, I will have an answer in 14 days. He had his staff working in three shifts, 8 hour shifts, 24 hours a day. But then after authorization from the FDA, typically that is when a pharmaceutical company starts manufacturing because they don't want to put a lot of effort and resources into it before they know it's going to be approved. So we took as much of that as possible. So from phase one to phase two to phase three clinical trials was measured in days, not months. We used a lot of the NIH's clinical trial sites, like oncology clinical trial sites, to work with the CROs that brought their own sites to bear. And those trials, we helped recruit, patients or individuals for trials. They weren't necessarily patients. A lot of them were healthy, obviously. We did all that. And then we began manufacturing in the summer of 2020. Remember, the first emergency use authorization was granted on December 11th. So we were already manufacturing. And it's the first time in history that there were millions of doses of vaccines available and being shipped 24 hours after the FDA authorized it. Use, right? So that was one principle. When it came to governance, it was really fascinating. And I spent 25 years at McKinsey & Company leading a lot of transformational efforts in large corporations. And it's a very similar principle. And that is, when you have an emergency like this in any organization, you can't let the bureaucracy bog you down. So what we did was set up a Operation Warp Speed Board, which was co-chaired by Secretary Mark Esper at the Department of Defense and Secretary Alex Azar. And then we had a number of physicians, you can imagine Francis Collins and Tony Fauci and Deb Burks and Moncef Slaoui and Bob Kadlec and others on it. And we had some White House representatives on it. So Jared Kushner and Adam Bowler and Brad Smith. And what we did was met every Friday morning as a Operation Warp Speed board to make decisions. And if we needed any support at all beyond that board, we had a direct line of sight to the Oval Office. Didn't have to talk to anyone else. So, I'd pick up the phone, I'd call Jared Kushner and said, Jared, we need to get in and see the boss today. It's very important. And sure enough, we'd be in to see President Trump, right? And that took weeks and months off of contracting issues, off of Defense Production Act use issues. There was no, deliberating, if you will. It was all action. So that was a very important principle. The third one I talked about was this venture capital mindset that Moncef Slaoui had. And Moncef Slaoui is the most successful vaccine developer of our generation. He brought 14 vaccines successfully to market when he was at GlaxoSmithKline for his career. But he's a strategist at heart. He's a brilliant strategist. And he laid out the candidate investment portfolio that we had. And some people in the scientific community were saying, literally, they used a term, and I put this in the book, get every horse you possibly can in the race. Invest in 20 of these things, right? And, you know, intuitively, you would say, that's not a bad recommendation, because the more bets you place, the more chance you have of winning. However, what those scientists didn't understand that Moncef Slaoui and Gus Perna understood was that the more you invest in, the less probability you have of getting through clinical trials, because you need 30,000 persons in each clinical trial. If you had 20 different trials going on at once, that's 600,000 Americans that would have to go through. You would eventually have potentially a shortage of raw materials.
Yeah.
You would add to the complexity of distribution. These vaccines took different size needles, different size syringes. They had to be stored and distributed under different conditions, like minus 80 degrees Celsius versus refrigeration. So the complexity of the supply chain issues would grow exponentially as you added vaccine candidates. So we limited ourselves to 6 and potentially 7, but we said no more than that, across 3 technology platforms and 2 candidates in each platform. And in August of 2020, we decided to perform a little bit what I call of trust but verify. So Moncef had laid out his candidates, syndicated it with the board. And what we did was we evaluated each candidate on 3 dimensions. The probability they could get emergency use authorization before year end, their ability to scale up manufacturing, because what good is an emergency use authorization if you can't have millions of doses, right? Of you know, if you didn't have any product after you get the authorization, that could be very frustrating. And then the third characteristic was, would they be effective in those over age 65? Because we weren't really interested in a vaccine that was going to help 7-year-olds. And the reason we weren't is we knew it in the summer of 2020 that this was a virus that disproportionately affected those with certain underlying conditions and mainly the elderly. So we used those criteria and we performed what I call a cumulative probability analysis. This was in August of 2020. And we went out and asked a bunch of experts about our vaccine candidates and said, what do you think on, can they manufacture at scale? From the early trials, does it look like those over age 65 will be protected? Are they sophisticated enough in their clinical trial management to get through it and get to an EUA before year end? And the answer that came up, the cumulative probability analysis suggested that we had a 75% probability of having at least one safe and effective vaccine manufactured at scale, effective in those over age 65 before year end, and a 32% chance we'd have 2, and less than 10% chance we'd have 3. And we wound up with 2, which was interesting. But one more point about this analysis that was fascinating, we were considering a 7th candidate. And every candidate we invested in was about $2.5 billion.
Jeez.
And as I mentioned, the complexity goes up. So we ran the 7th company through our probability analysis, and it only took the 75% probability to 78%. So we said, it's not worth the leadership dilution. It's not worth the complexity in the supply chain, and it's not worth the $2.5 billion. So anyway, we used that tool very successfully to help us make decisions. But these were the principles. And again, I think the one that we talked about earlier, Scott, was our role was to enable the private sector to be successful. So a very important principle we established from day one was, do not permit the federal government to do anything that the private sector can do better. And we had internal debates. The CDC, I talk about this in the book, and I don't want to disparage the CDC, but they had a strong preference for using the public health infrastructure to distribute and administer vaccines. Gus Perna in the Army Materiel Command said, you know what, we have a preference for CVS and Walgreens and Walmart and UPS and FedEx. And of course that won out the private sector, but you know, the America's public sector infrastructure is dilapidated at best. They don't have electronic scheduling of patients. They don't know how to call patients back for their second doses. I mean, we looked into all this stuff and we said, you gotta be crazy if you think you're gonna use them to get 300 million Americans vaccinated. So anyway, those were the principles. And I think it's based, a lot of it was based in a philosophy, an underlying philosophy of a belief in the private sector.
Yeah, I wanna fast forward now. The vaccine's ready, it's ready to go. And let's talk about the private sector and talk about, and everyone knows McKesson was the exclusive distributor of the vaccine. So I want to talk about what role they played in Operation Warp Speed in getting this out and getting the vaccine out as rapidly as it happened.
Yeah. So McKesson had already had an existing contract with the CDC for, I think, flu vaccines, to tell you the truth, and the distribution of them on an annual basis. So we very quickly came to the conclusion that given their knowledge of how the government operated, their relationships they had, and of course their reputation, which was stellar in the industry, that we would just go with McKesson for this broader role. But we added a very important task that I think is underappreciated, or at least not very well known in the country. And that is, one of our roles at the federal government was to ensure that when these vaccines went out, that what accompanied them was all of the needles, all of the syringes, all of the PPE. If the vaccine required an adjuvant, which is a booster, all of that stuff would be put into kits and sent out with the vaccines. And indeed, what we did was we goosed up those kits by 10%. So if we were sending out 100 doses of vaccine, we would send out 110 needles and syringes, because we didn't want someone dropping a needle or dropping a syringe to preclude that vaccine from being used. And these had short shelf life, so they had to be used, right? And so McKesson reorganized its warehouses and they kitted hundreds and hundreds of millions of these needles and syringes, got them to the distribution hubs in Kentucky with UPS and FedEx, and they went out to all of the 70,000 vaccine administration sites that we had in our IT system, and they did it flawlessly. So they played just such a spectacular role in doing that. And again, I think it's underappreciated, certainly under, you know, advertised, but vitally important role.
It's amazing when you put somebody in the game that is a Tom Brady, yeah. for lack of a better term. How much better they do than trying to do it yourself. So kudos to McKesson and to you guys for knowing, hey, let's let the private sector manage this and distribute it and get it out. I've taken a ton of your time today. I do have two final questions for you. One, I'd like to know kind of lessons learned through this. And then secondly, can you tell the audience where your book's available and when it will be out? I know the print is a little delayed because of supply chain. So those two questions, kind of lessons learned and then the book.
I think the lessons learned, the main lesson learned, well, let me start by saying this, Scott, this is a uplifting story.
100%.
About America. I end the book by saying, you know, amid all this divisiveness and tolerance and political divisions and so forth, hopefully Americans can be very proud of how exceptional America truly is. The only country in the world that offered vaccines to every one of its citizens by April of 2021, only 15 months after the virus was characterized, its DNA, right? It's just extraordinary level of innovation and in what I call in the book, industrial dexterity and nimbleness and talent and capability that we have, right? So I think the lesson learned is a lot of people disparage large corporations and, you know, greedy, you know, oh, they make too much money, all this other stuff. But in times of need, there's no better place to be than within American industry and having them at your disposal to enable them as I said before, to be successful. And I think without the development that had taken place decades before, mRNA technology, warehouse management, distribution management, information technology, CVS and Walgreens having clinics and, you know, tens of thousands of clinics. If we didn't have that at a starting point, we never would have gotten through this. So let's not disparage our large corporations for, you know, being profitable because they developed unprecedented capabilities that no other country in the world had. I think that's the main lesson. The book is up on Amazon. It is there for pre-order. Let me just give you a couple of dates. March 15th, so very quickly. The electronic version, for anyone who has a Kindle or other type of device, can download it. The paper, the hardcover version, won't be out until sometime in early to mid-May. But still, this would be a great time to pre-order. So please go to Amazon if you like the story. I think you'll find it uplifting and you won't regret spending $20 or so.
Paul, I appreciate you being here. When it does come out in print in May, make sure you ping me and I will put it in our daily news, which goes out to about 30,000 folks a day, and let them know that the print version is there. But man, thank you for what you did for the country. Thank you for getting out of the way for the private sector. And man, I appreciate you for being on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks, Scott. It's a real honor. And hopefully this will be uplifting for your listeners.
Absolutely. It was for me. I know that. What an incredible story. And again, thank you so much, man.
My pleasure.
Wow. So cool coming out of that conversation with Paul and all of the things they did. I think a couple of things that jump right out at me is one, they came up with Operation Warp Speed on March 28th, 29th of 2020. We were right in the middle of it. It just blows me away. The second is, I know I sound like a bit of a nerd on these podcasts about healthcare distribution. I wouldn't want to work in any other industry anywhere else in the world than the United States of America, healthcare distribution with our distribution partners who step up every day and provide products to the frontline workers in America's health systems who do an incredible job. I think every one of you on both sides of that aisle, the distribution side and the manufacturing side, as well as the providers across our country. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Go out and buy Paul's book. I think you'll enjoy the read, but also it supports an American hero that stepped up with another group of people and got out of the way and let the private sector bring some things to market and take care of our caregivers and the American population in a way that is just an incredible American story. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Have a wonderful day.